Hello, everybody. Welcome back to The Doubters on Thursday, the 29th of October. I'm going at a bit of a different time. It's 7 o'clock here in the UK. We've got a guest here with us this evening. We've got Joya Georgewell, who's joining us from Bristol. Do you want to say hello, Joya?
Hi.
Joya's joining us from Bristol. Yeah, so this is The Doubters. This is my private online community. And this is a space where we aim to embrace self-doubt as a route to meaningful and sustainable growth. And that's, you know, that's a really challenging ask. And that's why I've created this community as a space to explore all the different aspects of that. What does that mean to us and how do we go about doing that? And I have different conversations with people around this. I go out live every week and you're really welcome to come and join us live throughout these sessions and contribute or just sit and listen, show up as you want to. As it happens today, it's just me and Joya at the moment. The waiting room is off. Some people may come and go throughout the session. That often does happen. Hopefully some people will come along and join us live. Always really like it when people do. There's actually no pressure or expectation for people to do that. So our topic today is owning our Black history. I'll explain what that's about. So it's Black History Month, and I really wanted to recognise that. You know, the what's been going on around Black Lives Matter movement and has been very important to me recently. So I wanted to recognise that. And how to do that was I invited my old friend Joya to come along and have this conversation. So our topic is owning our Black history. And what we're doing this evening, it's not, you know, it's not a history lesson. We're talking about this from a personal perspective. And also how that relates to self-doubt. I'm just really interested in exploring this conversation to see what comes up. We will just see what unfolds from that. But that's the premise behind it anyway. So let me introduce Joya to you. So Joya Georgewell is actually, she's an old friend of mine. Really pleased to have you here, Joya, this evening talking about this. So the reason we're going out at 7 o'clock, a different time for me, is that Joya is actually, she's come along this evening. Usually people come along here and they have a public profile and something that, you know, they can talk about their own business. Joya doesn't have a public profile. Joya is actually an NHS worker. So she's one of our nation's heroes during COVID. I'm sure she will hate me saying that. So that's why we're going out in the evening, because she's got a proper job. But having said that, actually, Joya, you're studying at the moment, aren't you? You're studying for a master's in arts therapy. So hopefully we'll get on to talk a little bit about what that means to you as well. So I know that's really important. Mm-hmm. So Joya, as I said, an old friend of mine. I like to introduce people through my connection with them. And actually, Joya and I met through Alcoholics Anonymous. We spoke about this yesterday, about whether it's okay for me to say that or not. And Joya said, yes, she's happy for me to do that. And I've spoken about my recovery in this group before. And I used to live in Bristol a long time ago. We go back quite a way now, don't we, Joya? Mm-hmm. So that's how I know Joya. We connected quite a long time ago. So Joya, you know, I'm really glad to have you here this evening. Is there anything that you feel like you want people to know about you before we start off?
I don't know. First of all, I'd just like to say thank you for inviting me, Olivia. And I don't really know what I want people to know before I start off. My name's Joya. I'm a mother. I've got 3 adult children and 2 grandchildren. I think that's about it for now.
Okay, great. No worries. We'll get on to this conversation about our Black history. So Joya, we connected recently and we were talking about some of these issues, and we were talking about kind of the difference that's happened for both of us and the awareness that has been raised actually since the events around George Floyd, what's happened recently. We were talking about that. So I felt that you would be a really good person to have on talking about this topic. Now, you grew up in an all white community in Bristol. As a Black person, and I was just wondering, maybe you could start off by saying, you know, what was your community like that you grew up in? Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, I was thinking about it. I've been thinking about it because of the conversations that we've had, but also because of the recent events. And this morning I picked up, it was my birthday recently, and I was given this. I was given this for my birthday, Black and British. And I haven't read it yet. I'm trying to read all sorts of other things to do with the course that I'm doing. But just the first few pages that I read, and I just thought, wow, I really identify with this person, you know, who's written the book. I was brought up on a council estate. When I say it was a council estate, it wasn't actually. There were council houses and private houses all mixed in together, really. And it was a white community, all white community. My mum's white, my mum's German. And me, my brother and my sister were the only children or people of colour, if you like, in the whole community. So, and it was in the 60s. I was born in 1960. So my mum lived in the inner city to start off with. But not for very long, and then moved into the suburbs, I don't know, a village, really, on the outskirts of a village, the Badminton Estate. So a very different, but I was very young then. So, and that was my first school. My first school was in Tormartin, a little place called Tormartin. There was two classrooms. So I was there for a little while, and then went to care for a little while and lived in the Cotswolds, Woodland Edge, for a little while. That's a all-white community as well. So, yeah, I was brought up with amongst white people in the white community.
Okay. Yeah. I was thinking it may have been similar to the area I grew up. I was born in 1972 and moved down to southeast of England from the northeast. When I was six, so late 70s, and the community I grew up in was an all-white community as well. There wasn't any black people at all. I don't remember anybody of colour, actually. It was kind of a small village on the outskirts of Watford where I grew up. And there was a big skinhead community where we grew up.
You know, I'm a skinhead now.
You are skinhead now.
And yeah. Dr. Martin's.
Don't mind you. Yeah. Yeah. Kevin's just joined us. Welcome, Kevin. Yeah, great. So yes, it might have been fairly similar, but I guess I'm interested, you know, what's interesting is you growing up as that, as the only person of colour. What was that like for you?
I don't know. Very, very early in my life, I think I learned to, I mean, for me to be able to exist in the white community that I grew up in, I discovered through counselling that I denied my skin colour to myself. And I did that very well. I needed to do that to be able to survive, really. Within that community, you know, if people began to talk about or make jokes. At that time in the 60s, there were television programs like, you know, Black and White Minstrels. There were gollywogs on jam jars. It was quite, it seemed to be okay for people to call you a nigger or a wog or a sambo or a coon or, you know, those kind of I don't know what you just call it. That was quite common. So it was difficult because it was because there wasn't anyone else to discuss it with or talk to or go to. My mum was a single parent. I didn't have a father, and there wasn't anybody else to talk to. So I forgot what the question was, Olivia.
I was talking about what it was like for you growing up.
Difficult, really difficult.
This person kind of you talked
frightening.
About.
Frightening. Yeah. Frightening. Yeah, it was frightening, it was difficult. And so I suppose I learned to avoid certain situations. And I remember when I used to walk to school, I think to the secondary school, when I was, say, about 11, and we lived near a factory. There were a couple of factories in the community where I lived, and coach loads of men, possibly and women, but mainly men, I think, travelled in from Bristol to the community where I lived. I lived in a place called Yates, and And I used to walk, and when I saw these coaches, all these people, the coaches were filled up with black faces, just black people looking out of the window of a coach and smiling at me, and maybe even waving. But I would just put my head down because I couldn't afford to identify with these people.
Right.
So I suppose what happened was that the racism that I experienced, I internalized, and I was the same. So I rejected black people completely.
Wow.
Yeah. So,
we talk about in self-doubt, you know, doubting ourselves, questioning ourselves, you know, that's you know, a classic example of it. I mean, it's an example that I don't relate to in that way, obviously. You know, I've never had to think about what it means to be white. You know, that's never been a question for me. Mm-hmm. And obviously you said you had to deny your skin colour and it wasn't safe for you to identify with this skin colour. And so when we think about in terms of self-doubt, that is like, I don't quite know how to put that into words, but that's, you know, that's a very extreme form of it, you know, actually denying this part of your identity. And you talked about the language there that they used. I mean, it's quite shocking actually to think about and remember how common it was to speak like that. And I think, you know, nowadays, you know, this is one of the things that where, you know, there has been a lot of progress made, isn't it? Because we don't hear that kind of language nowadays. And that's good. It's good that it is shocking to hear that, you know, in some ways. I know that we've still got a long way to go, but it is good to recognise how some things have changed, I guess. So when did you start coming to terms with being black? Or your blackness? Because obviously you know you've got a black father and a white mother, haven't you? So
And the white mother was just as difficult as the black father. My mum's German, and so living in England in the 60s as a German woman, that was just as difficult for her.
Wow.
And for us as well.
Yes,
it was like double, you know, double whammy, really. I forgot what you said again, Olivia.
I said, you know, when did you start coming to terms with the black in you? I don't want to say being black.
When I had started to have counselling, I think, when I was about in my 30s. Because, you know, I had children, and I can remember my son as a teenager coming home and talking like he was a black, like how I, you know, how black people spoke in Bristol, you know. When he came in, I'd say to him, don't come in here talking like you're a black man, because you're not black. And I denied to my son that he was black. And I suppose, I'm not sure that I was aware of it at that time, but I you know, when I reflected back on that, you know, I tried to deny my children, you know, their identity, if you like, or the identity that they were trying to find, their own identity. I tried to push to prevent that in the same way as I suppose I was prevented as a child, or, you know, to protect myself. By this time I'd moved into an area where there were more it was more, you know, diverse ethnic.
I suppose you're talking about the 90s by then, haven't they? So
my son was born in the 80s.
Right.
Yeah. But it would have been the 90s, yeah, because by then he was a teenager, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I you know, when I was having counselling, and for something else, and my counsellor asked me what it was like being brought up in the white community, and I said to her, I don't quite know how we got to this, but I said to her, I was going to AA. I was quite new at that time in AA, and I said to her that what I would do, I would go to, if I was going to share in meetings, every time I identified myself, I was going to identify as, with my name, Joya, That I'm a real black alcoholic. That's how I was going to identify myself for the week. And I said, well, I'll come back next week and let you know what that was like.
A counselling experiment.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah, wow.
And I left my counselling, which was on, I think it was on a Monday. It must have been on a Monday, because on my way home, I got a phone call from somebody who asked me to share at a meeting the following day, on Tuesday. And I thought, and I said I would, and I thought, my God, you know, I said that I'm going to introduce myself. It's Joya, real black alcoholic, you know, and I'd never done that before. Mm. And So I did. And I went to the meeting, and there was somebody there that I felt quite uncomfortable around, actually, and I didn't really feel safe getting myself, like, being vulnerable in front of this person. And for me to actually do that for the first time was making, you know, I was getting really vulnerable. Mm. I got to the meeting, and I'm sat at the table, and I thought I was going to vomit. I felt sick. I thought, I'm going to throw up all over this table. And I was thinking about going to the toilet and just making myself sick, because I felt so, so anxious. Anyway, I didn't. I sat there, and when the person introduced me, I introduced myself, and I said that my name's Joya, and I am a real black alcoholic. And wow. And I did that for myself. I did that for me. It was about me owning, like you were saying, about owning my own, myself, owning that part of me that is black, because it's not all of me, but that part of me that I denied for so long.
Yeah.
And also calling myself by my name, Joya, because my family and the people that I grew up with call me Joy. And I called myself, and I was okay with that, because Joy is an unusual name. And I didn't want to be unusual. I didn't want to be set apart or for people to, I just wanted to blend in.
Yeah.
Joy is, you know, there's lots of joys, and, you know, and so when I first joined the fellowship, I remember somebody saying to me, you know, what's your name? And I said, my name's Joy. And the person said, is that the name you were given at birth? And I said, no, Joya, but you can call me Joy. And he said, the first thing it takes is your name. And he said, you need to reclaim your name. And they said
the first thing it takes is your name. What did they mean by that?
Well, I'm not quite sure what they meant. I kind of,
did they mean alcoholism, or?
He just said the first thing it takes.
Wow.
I kind of know what that means for me now, but at the time it kind of resonated with me somehow. And I thought, yeah, okay, well, I'm needing to make lots of changes in my life, and I'm meeting new people. Mm. So whenever anybody asks me what my name is, I'm going to say my name's Joya. And so each time I said that my name was Joya, I couldn't speak. My voice went, and I discovered from that there was a lot of trauma attached to my name, and I found it really difficult to communicate, you know, to speak out, you know, and to say my name. So, but I persevered.
Yeah.
I persevered until I found that I was able to say my name, that without, you know, and that, and feel comfortable, you know, feel comfortable in my own skin, you know, and begin to like myself, because I didn't like my name. I didn't like where I grew up. I didn't like the people I grew up with. I didn't like you. I didn't like me. I didn't like anything much, you know, and at that time, you know, my life was pretty shit, and that, you know, I just like felt like shit, and, you know, life was shit, and you were shit, and everything was shit. Mm-hmm. But gradually I began to like myself, and feel comfortable with myself, and feel comfortable in my own skin. So I, you know, at that meeting, so this person who'd said to me, you know, the first thing it takes is your name. So I was able to introduce myself and as Joya. But I hadn't said that I was, I'd never said that I was a real alcoholic, or, you know, there was a time when I thought, what what's that? What's a real alcoholic? Oh my God. You know, what if I'm not allowed to stay here? Do you know what I mean? I'll end up drinking again and I'll die. Do you know what I mean? Because I can remember somebody sharing that once in a meeting and saying, you know, the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking, but you better be a real alcoholic. And I thought, don't say that, don't say that in there. I'm sure it doesn't say that.
Yeah.
But, you know, I was afraid, I suppose, that again, I doubted myself. Do you know what I mean? And afraid to speak up and afraid to ask questions and afraid I'd get kicked out. And there's not very many black people in fellowship in Bristol.
I was going to explain that, actually. You know, that is a bit of an issue around AA as a whole, isn't it? There's a lack of representation in AA. And I often wonder what it must be like for people of colour coming into rooms, especially for the first time, and not having that representation. I know that's a challenge. But let me just pick up on a few of the things you're saying there, Joya, because Joya, make sure I say your name properly. And
I know who I am.
You know, because I actually find your story so moving when you talk about it, because what I'm hearing you is somebody who is claiming their identity and how you went about doing the touching way that you went about doing that, because it wasn't that you had anybody to say to you about this is what it means to be black and this is what you do. You didn't have that kind of cultural influence around you at that time. So you had to find your way in claiming what it meant to be that for you. And, you know, and I love the way, you know, you talk about so openly about your children, your relationship with your children and how, you know, you put this on them. You know, you're not black. You're not black. And what I hear that, you know, that you talked about blending in for safety. Mm. And obviously, and that I think is where the challenge is. You know, I think a lot of people, this work leads to around our identity and what it means to claim our identity and our different parts of it. But I think the difference that, you know, what you're bringing here and what you're talking about here is where you weren't allowed to have your identity. You know, so it was almost like it just wasn't safe for you to have your identity as a colour. And we talk about intersectionality. I had a diversity consultant on here a few months ago, and he's talking about intersectionality. Mm-hmm. And obviously, you know, all our identities are intersectionality, but you've got the challenge there of the Nigerian father, a black father, German mother, and what that meant growing up with a German mother. I mean, oh gosh, that's a double. And then being an alcoholic on top of that as well, mm-hmm. and finding your way through all of that in how to be me in this world. And that takes a huge amount of courage. And I really want to acknowledge you for that. And I want to thank you, you know, for coming on here and talking about that so openly. You know, it's really meaningful.
Yeah.
Yeah, Kevin said he's going to have to go in a minute. That's absolutely fine. Thanks, Kevin, for coming on. We're a bit sparse on the ground tonight, but that's fine. We're carrying on anyway. No problem at all. Yeah. Yeah, so that takes a lot of courage and claiming your identity. And, you know, so what are some of the other challenges you think you've had around this?
I as you were talking, it's funny, you know, that things pop up, don't they, as people are talking. And what was I thinking of as you were speaking? I think you were talking about, I mean, I think as I was listening to you, I was thinking it's an ongoing journey, you know, and although I reclaimed, you know, my name and, you know, partly my identity to start off with, I think was, I found an identity in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, that my name's Joy and I'm an alcoholic, you know, or a recovering alcoholic. And, so for a while it was that. And I know what I was thinking of. I was thinking about when at one time I was in Al-Anon, and my journey started in Al-Anon. And
To intersect there, that Al-Anon is the partner of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's the families of alcoholics, yeah. So you're in Al-Anon, yeah.
Yeah, I was there. And there were, you know, several people in the meeting who were alcoholics, who shared their experience, their story. And fortunately for me, and they carried the message to me, which was great. But I continued to go to Al-Anon before I joined AA. So I was there for a year before I joined AA. And then there was a steering meeting one evening, and and I thought that it would be a really good idea to invite AA members to the meeting to share their experience in the way that they did when I first joined, because had that not happened, I might not have got the message. And I thought it was great. Anyway, the Al-Anon members who were there at the time didn't think that was such a good idea, because they didn't have as many meetings as alcoholics. And and they said, and one person said, we don't want alcoholics in the meeting. And I said, well, I'm an alcoholic. And she said, well, you know, there's lots of meetings for alcoholics. And then somebody else tried to come to my rescue, I think, and said, yeah, but Joya, you're all right. You're okay. We don't mind you coming to the meeting because, you know, you're okay. I felt really angry. It really triggered something in me. And what it triggered was that it was like where I grew up, you know, it was like having a foot in two worlds. It was like, you can be here. We'll accept you so long as you don't acknowledge the fact that you're black, you know, and it, in that fellowship in Al-Anon, it felt to me at the time that it was okay for me to be there, but I couldn't mention that as an alcoholic, or don't talk about your alcoholism here. Mm-hmm. And so for a long time in the fellowships,
almost like having to deny part of yourself again to belong to a certain group.
Yeah. And, you know, and my journey into the fellowship has been, you know, so if I'm in one group of people, then don't talk about this that's happened to you. You can't talk about that. And so sometimes I find it really difficult to be able to speak, because I've got to compartmentalize all these different things that have happened and not share about that here. Don't share about that there. And sometimes I find that difficult. So what that did for me on that particular day was I felt just really angry. Then somebody said, well, why don't you start your own meeting for double winners? And I thought, I will. That's what I'll do. I didn't, but that's what I thought I'd do. And I left. I left Al-Anon. And I think at the time, maybe it was necessary for me to leave because I really needed to properly join AA. And I don't know if I would have done that without that happening. So I left on a resentment, left Al-Anon on a resentment.
So what you're talking there is about turning that experience and, you know, to your advantage, recognising the advantage from that challenging experience you had. But when you... Mm. When you talked about there about having to compartmentalize what you were saying and parts of yourself to bring to the environment or to the company you're in, I mean, that's a really common challenge that come across around self-doubt and people having to deny parts of themselves, you know. So I'm hearing this throughout your story, and I think people will probably relate to that in a certain way. But again, you know, what I will reiterate is that, you know, I think the challenge that we're talking about here around the black history and the black identity was that, you know, it was kind of enforced from society. That's a different thing. And that's you know, that's an experience I can't relate to. You know, white people can't relate to them. This is white privilege. You know, I've never had to think about what it means to be white. I've never had to, you know, think about that. And obviously, you know, you had to really come to terms with this to kind of claim that part of your identity. So, you know, we were talking recently about the impact of George Floyd and what's happened, you know, only fairly recently. And, you know, I know you talked about, you know, this being an ongoing journey for you. And so, you know, I was just wondering, would you mind speaking a little bit about what those events meant to you and how that has helped you or helped you or hindered you, or what's that meant, what that has meant for you in terms of claiming your identity?
Yeah. It's played a huge part in that, really, I think, because it was shocking. It was so shocking. The reaction to that was huge. And then following that, there were lots of on social media, there were lots of things posted. And I remember watching a video of a mother who I can't remember what she said, but But what I identified with was the pain that she experienced of having a son, a black son, or a son that's mixed race, and what that's like, you know. And so for myself as a woman, it's been difficult, and I've experienced all sorts of all sorts of difficulties, racism in all sorts of different ways, but not in the way that the men do. And my son, I felt the pain of the woman, of a woman sharing on a video that was posted on Facebook. And
then, what, George Floyd's mum?
It wasn't George Floyd's mum. No, it was a mother, a black mother, or a mother with a black child, with a black son, adult child, you know. Yeah. And the fear of knowing that what they might be experiencing. And I remember going to the fair with my son and my granddaughter, and just walking around the fairground, and I became very aware of the security, the people that were, you know, security at the fair, getting closer to us, and intimidating, and I'd never really quite seen that before, and I thought, and I could feel the tension, and I just, you know, I just wanted my granddaughter, my son, me and my son, my granddaughter on, and we left. I said to him, we need to go. Let's just go. But that kind of, that's the sort of experience that my son lives with constantly. And so with that event, you know, came lots of like books. I've got so many here now, which I never had before. So I've got this one, Natives, this one.
That and Race and Class in the Ruins of Empire.
That I haven't read, but I've read some of it.
Yeah.
I think his sister's what's her name, Dynamite. And then this one, How to Argue with a Racist.
How to Argue with a Racist, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And this one, My Grandmother's Hand.
My Grandmother's Hand. I've just ordered that. Yeah, really interested in that.
Me and White Supremacy.
Me and White Supremacy, yeah.
There was nothing like this. There was nothing like this. When I was growing up, there was nothing like this. And then, you know, this one that somebody's...
Black and British, Forgotten History, David Olusoga, who lives in Bristol, I think, doesn't he?
I think so. It's just incredible, you know, that there's, there's a lot to, you know, then there's Maya Angelou, which is great, why have Caged Bird Sings and things like that, you know, which is, you know, very aware of. And then Alice Miller, Pictures of Childhood, because of the art psychotherapy that I'm doing, yeah. So... looking at things like that. So there's I got lots of books and not enough time to read them.
I think this is a great challenge to have. And I just want to talk about how those kind of events, we were talking about the events of George Floyd, for the person who's just come and joined us here, is that you know, how those events impacted me as a white person. You know, it was just horrific to see that. And I think you know, just brought all the issues to a new level of awareness, to a point where so many people, and I think particularly so many white people, said, right, this can't happen anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, this, we don't want this to happen anymore. And what can we do? What can I do to stop this? You know, and, you know, it's really interesting because my history, I think I mentioned to you, I was doing family constellations. I've done a lot of family constellations work and delving into the history of my family. Was that my ancestors were ship owners in the 19th century, and there was a question, well, were they involved in slavery? And I was horrified. I was absolutely horrified. I mean, I'd only vaguely knew that there was a shipping connection, but when I realized being asked that question, I thought, I need to find out. And I looked into it, and I don't believe they were. From what I know, I don't believe they were. For one thing, it was later. It was like, so it was after, they didn't get into shipping until the late 1800s, and slavery was abolished before. Now I know that there's sort of indirect links to the industry and that kind of stuff. But it was really important for me to find out. To find that out. And actually, you know, I could trace my history quite easily, which was a good thing to be able to do, you know. But
it's something that I can't.
That's the thing I was going to ask you about, that, because you've not been able to trace your history. I think this is one of the challenges, isn't it?
Yeah,
because your dad's Nigerian, right?
Nigerian, yeah. And dead. Yeah.
Did you know him when you were growing up?
No, my mum and him separated when I was 2 and I was like nearly 3. And then I didn't have any contact with him. I lived with my mum until I was 15. Mm. And then at 15, by 15, I was angry. I was angry and I was drinking. And, you know, whatever I experienced as a child growing up, you know, the fear that I, you know, grew up with, alcohol took that away. And, when I drank, I didn't care. Yeah. But what that did was it interfered, or it destroyed the relationship I had with my mum. So at 15, I left home and tried to get in contact with my dad, you know, hoping, thinking and believing that, you know, he'd rescue me, he'd save me, everything would be all right by, you know, anyway. So I wasn't quite sure what to do to start off with, but in the end it was really simple. I just went into the phone book and looked up his name, my name, and found someone by that name in the city, you know, where I lived, or near to where I lived, and rang them. Yeah. And it was his wife. He was married and it was his wife, but he'd left the UK 7 years or 8 years before that and gone back to Nigeria. You know, at that point I was really worried, because my mum, the relationship that they had wasn't a good relationship. It was quite violent, and she was scared, you know, and I didn't want to, as much as I wasn't, you know, I didn't have a fantastic relationship with her at that time. Mm. I still didn't want to bring, you know, harm to her, really. Mm. He did contact us, and his wife contacted him, and through her, we had contact, and he wrote a letter. One of the things that he said was, don't be sluggish like the English children and read the Bible from the bottom of beer bottles on a Sunday. And I remember reading, thinking that, and thinking, who do you think you are telling me what to do? I drink, and Sunday's my favorite day. So what I did was I put my relationship with alcohol at that time before the relationship that I had that I could have perhaps had with my dad. Yeah. And I didn't have any contact with him again at all until I stopped drinking. And when I stopped drinking, by the time I stopped drinking, he'd been dead for 8 years. So, you know, I did contact some of his family, but not him. So mm-hmm. I didn't end up meeting him.
And that's sad. And of course, you know, alcohol is a very effective survival strategy for this this internal battle that we talk about, or, you know, around self-doubt, which can manifest as self-doubt, but, you know, this sense of not belonging and, you know, what is my identity and that kind of stuff. Mm. We have a friend here who's joined us, Nayasiga Naboth. I don't know if I say your name correctly. Our friend, I think he's joining us from Ghana. If you want to come and join the conversation, say anything, make any contributions, or ask a question, feel free to do that. You're very welcome to. No pressure to either. Are you able to ask a question in the chat box? Because we can't hear you, I'm afraid. He's going to type in the chat box. I'm going to put him back on mute. So, Joy, while we're waiting for our friend's question to come through, Isis's internet connection is not good. It's such a shame. Thank you for coming anyway. And if you want to ask a question, just feel free to type it in the chat box. Yeah. So Joya, I just want to finish off by asking you about the work that you're doing now, your studies you're doing now, because I believe, you know, all the stuff that we've spoken about today is having an impact on your studies.
Yeah. So I'm doing a master's in art psychotherapy, and I've got a dissertation to write this year. And this is my final year. And I've just pulled it up on here because I don't know what the what the topic is going to be. But at the moment it says exploring the experience of an MA art psychotherapist in training as a person of colour. And I've said that because it's really difficult within the institution, the educational institution. There's no lectures or anything like that on race or culture or difference or that kind of diversity. There is, but not specifically to do with racism or racism mm-hmm. really, but that sort of thing, institutional racism. And I think that it needs to be. So I am exploring, what my experience of being an art psychotherapist in training as a person of colour. And the reason for that is that there are not very many art therapists or therapists of colour for people that may need help. It can be quite difficult for I'm saying people of colour. I'm not even sure of the terms I want to use or I like to use, and that's something else that I need to explore as well. But just for now, I'm saying people of colour. Mm. I belong to another fellowship, ACA POC, and that's for adult children of alcoholics, for people of colour. And I've got it written down here that people of colour are defined as people who are descendants of Africa, Asia, Indigenous Australia, Native American, Latino, Chicano, people of colour from the Middle East, or anyone of mixed mm-hmm. racial heritage, including one or more of the above. And so there's, and then I also had somebody sent me through something called hashtag BAME, and that's all about, not being identified as an acronym, really, But all of these, again, these are all changes, aren't they? They're all changes. And I don't even know how I feel So I'm exploring that for myself, as well at the moment. And I'm really early into doing that. I've forgotten again what you said.
I was talking about your studies and how you're bringing these challenges you've had into your studies, how they're influencing your studies.
There's an overrepresentation. I'm hoping to work in prisons, and there's an overrepresentation of black men in prisons. And I mean, I don't know whether people want to communicate or talk with. It's a bit hard to trust when you're in that kind of environment, but I want to be able to help where I can, whether that's in prison or wherever it is, help people to be able to express themselves and to feel safe, to be able to do that safely. Which is why, in the ACA POC meetings, it's only black people that can be there, because it's been so unsafe to be able to bring these topics, these issues, out into the open, for people of colour. The conversations are different. And, there was a programme on for children at school, weren't there? I don't know if you saw it, it's on Channel 4, I think.
But they did that experiment in the school about
amazing.
It was. Yeah, the race experiment. Yeah. Mm. It was incredible. It was incredible. I think that opened my eyes a lot, actually. I learned a lot from watching that.
Mm, me too.
Because I think, I say it again, I never had to think about what it meant to be white. And and I could sit here and I want to be able to say, in an ideal world, we wouldn't have these issues. Do you know what I mean? You could go to a white person and talk openly about who you are, and I could go to a black person and talk openly about who I am. But that statement, I recognise, is coming from a white privileged place. And a place of ignorance, actually. I feel that. And I think this is what's what's really opened my eyes recently is to understand, and actually, so I'm married, my husband is Asian, and he was born in Nairobi. So, you know, he's more connected with Africa than he is with Asia. His family's Goan, but he doesn't really sort of relate to Goa. He's more sort of connected, I guess, with Africa. You know, he lived there until he was six. And, he classes himself as British. Of course, he's grown up in this country. But anyway, he's a person of colour. And it's only really through conversations with him or living with him that I've come to understand that I will never understand what it means to be a person of colour in this country and the impact of that. And it's through the very subtle sort of conversations we've had about things that's opened my eyes up to that. And so I guess, what am I saying here? You know, I think what's good is to really have this awareness. You know, at the heart of this, you know, I feel, or what I see in this, and especially around the challenge around self-doubt, it is about identity, how we identify, and finding that sense of belonging, finding places where we feel safe and where we belong, and communities and environments where that happens. And you know, and our world is just, you know, that's such a natural human desire to want that, and our world is not set up to make this easy for people of colour, I think. So it's really interesting to hear about the challenges that you're dealing with now in your studies, and how you're bringing that to your studies, and your desire to bring that into prisons specifically, and to have an impact there.
I'm so at the beginning of it all, you know, that and it's late, you know, it's late in my life, you know, to be doing it, but now's the time, you know, and I don't know where it will take me, or, you know, I just sometimes I don't feel as if there's enough time there's enough time for it all, you know. But I'm glad that I do feel that I do have this opportunity, and it's about you know, like I said, you know, like this, a friend of mine who said, because I felt quite nervous coming on here and not really knowing what was I going to say, and you know, and she said, this whole speaking up, you've never done it before, not about you know, my identity, my black identity, or the lost identity even, you know, because, and it's also for me, it's not just about, you know, black is one, that's one part of me. And then I, you know, I've also got a white, a German mother. My mum's father was Polish, and I've got a stepfather who's Hungarian, you know, but when you look at me, what you see is my skin colour. You don't see the German or the Polish or the Hungarian. I'm not Hungarian, that's not in me, but my brother, my half brother, my mum had another child who's white, and his dad's Hungarian. So, you know, and they all experienced, they all had their experiences, you know, in this country, and in their own countries as well, you know. And I think with this book, this here, it says, this one.
Yeah, the David Olusoga. Yeah.
In the first bit here, he says, and I didn't know this either, it says, he's a British Nigerian historian, broadcaster, and BAFTA award-winning presenter and filmmaker. His previous books include The Kaiser's Holocaust and The World's War. But it's talking about Germany and... you know, and the genocide there, and, you know, it's and how, you know, that how all that happens is you know, it's all to do with power, isn't it? You know, racism is to do with power, white supremacy. I don't have enough, you know, God, I wish I'd done this when I was a lot younger. I don't know how old you are, I can't say your name.
Naboth, I think you can call him.
He's very young. He's younger than me.
I think he's 19.
Pick this all up now, you know, while you're young. And and I just think I hope it's an opportunity for people of colour to be able to do this. I mean, it's difficult. because, you know, one of the what I was going to say was that we're dehumanized. Do you know what I mean? And it's how this all happened. You know, I was brought up, I didn't say this earlier, I was brought up in a community where the media, you know, representation of black people was that black people were subhuman, gorilla-like creatures that wore bones through their noses, wore grass skirts, lived in mud huts, carried spears and ate people. That's what I was brought up with. That was the wow. concept that I was wow. brought up with, that black. So, you know, as a child myself, I didn't want to have anything to do with these black people that lived in mud huts, that, you know, danced around with spears. I mean, it's a little bit like saying that British people, you know, are, what Morris dancers. It's like saying that Morris dancers, yeah. Do you know what I mean?
I know.
This is an English person, you know, it's yeah. ridiculous.
It is ridiculous. Yeah.
But that's what we were conditioned. That's what I was conditioned to believe. And, you know, if you saw any black people on the television, it's like my friend was saying to me the other day, you saw them with flies on their face and pot bellies and, you know, children that needed.
It's that representation, isn't it? That positive representation and being a role model. We're just coming up to time, actually. We're going to close off in a minute. But, you know, just to say, you know, I feel that as you talk about there, that history and that knowledge and that understanding where you've come from and what it was like is important. So you're saying, you know, I wish I had more time, but the time you've got, Joya, you know, you're using it well. And and I really hope, and I believe you will use all of that experience to a really positive advantage. Be able to the younger generation, you know, you don't need to go what I went through and I can be that positive representation.
And
you.
If I can go to university at 60 years of age, then so can anyone. So can anyone. And, you know.
I'm just going to read our friend's question here. I'm afraid I do struggle with pronouncing your name. Nayasiga Naboth. I'm listening live from Uganda in southwestern Uganda. We both have black people and white people in Uganda, but here we really respect people irrespective of their colour. Black, I feel touched, but I feel touched when I hear about racism. So, yeah, so that's really positive to hear that you have a much better situation over there now, at least in your day and age. And I know that a friend who's actually doing a lot of work around women's rights as well is very passionate about women's rights as well. So that's brilliant. Thank you. It's really good to see you here. So thank you for coming. Right. I'm going to close off the recording now, but stick around for a few minutes and we might have a chat afterwards. But Joya, I just want to say thank you so much for coming and sharing everything with us today. Really all the best of luck with your studies and really good to see you. So just to say next week before I close off, we're going to be talking about the gentle business revolution with a business consultant called Sarah Santa Croce. So she'll be here next week. We'll be back at 4 p.m. in the afternoon. So I look forward to seeing you next week.